Happy Tuesday.
It's not actually a Tuesday, but don't tell anyone. As always, I'm Patrick Rubio, Sports on Earth, and today we're having a special edition to talk about two big stories in international soccer, both of them bad, both involving corruption, both of them involving FIFA. Now, I know what you're thinking. Big surprise there. And it's true. We probably shouldn't be shocked by FIFA corruption, but we should be upset. And we should still want to get to the bottom of what's actually happening. So the first story involves major bribery in Qatar's successful bid to host the 2022, say that three times fast, World Cup. The second story involves match fixing in the run-up to the 2010 World Cup that was held in South Africa. Now, to discuss the match fixing, I'm going to bring on Brian Toohey, who's written books about sports fixing and is also our resident sports conspiracyologist here at Sports on Earth. But first, to talk about issue number one, the Qatar bid, the corruption around that, we have Sports on Earth's own Chuck Culpepper, podcast favorite, who also is by far our most globe-trotting correspondent and lived for a while in the Middle East. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
So let's get into Qatar. Over the weekend, Sunday Times of London had a big report claiming that they have, quote, millions of documents indicating payments to rig votes among FIFA committee members, who, by the way, everyone should know, they vote in secret, big surprise there, to send the 2022 World Cup to Qatar. Now, I know you've had a little bit of chance to digest the Times report. I know that this wasn't totally shocking because we had already heard reports that this had happened. They seem to have more goods than some of the earlier reports. For people who haven't been following, though, the story, can you kind of break down what the allegations are in a nutshell? Like, what's the alleged corruption here?
Just that a former FIFA official who is Qatari, mm-hmm. however, there's different ways to say that, but they say they have emails. I'm stunned by the millions part. I just didn't know there could be millions of emails about anything, really. But that
obviously you don't work for the NSA, Chuck.
Yeah, I guess so. Anything but that. So, that he was arranging to buy vote,
and quite a bit of vote buying, right?
That vote wound up. Well, that vote was in December of 2010. I was living in Abu Dhabi at the time, but I was spending a good bit of time in Qatar, twice right around there. And it was amazing. I mean, it's really funny, almost funny in a way, that a country that small could get an event that large, you know, the largest event. So, you know, there are only, you know, varying reports, but a few hundred thousand citizens of that country. So it finished ahead of the United States, South Korea, Japan, and Australia, three of the four of which have held a World Cup before.
And have the infrastructure in place.
Yes,
and held World Cups very successfully. It's funny, you mentioned this in your column, when you go back and look at that vote in 2010, Qatar got 14 votes. U.S. was second place with only 8. You made a great point. Australia got one vote. One vote. The quote you had from a quote-unquote a wise voice in Qatar who said, any balloting in which Australia gets only one vote to host a sporting event is automatically rigged. It sounds like there were suspicions about this even back then.
Yeah, I mean, with something like that, there's always that kind of snickering, or I shouldn't say there's always, because this is such a rare, you know, a rare happening that, but there was that kind of snickering because, you know, there's so much money involved. Those Qatar and the United Arab Emirates there have been really bold in pursuing sports in recent years, sporting events, you know, from the golf tour and tennis tours and Formula One and the UAE, United Arab Emirates, which is Dubai and Abu Dhabi, to the World Cup in Qatar. And they also had the Asian Cup in 2011, which was awarded to them before the World Cup vote. So, you know, those are among the rare places in the world where there's still a lot of money
Right.
flying around, even through the Great Recession, you know?
Right.
So, of course, that had all the marks of, you know, if you wanted to sit around in the and snicker about, boy, I wonder how they got that. It certainly was ripe for it. The
Well,
voting went in four rounds. Australia got one vote in the first round and was knocked out. So and that was the joke of the person whom I did not out in that
Right.
column, but who made that great point that, you know, Australia being the best sports country in the world, it's only one vote, so.
And like a great place to go for an event. Everybody loved the Sydney Olympics. Loved
Right.
them. I mean, when you read these pieces now, people are talking about how we should have a permanent home for the Olympics. And people suggest, well, let's do it in Greece every time, or let's do it in the US. I'm just like, no, let's do it in Australia. Everybody was really happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the best events anybody ever had, you know, and also had this element of it that you don't always find, which was the entire population seemingly galvanized behind a certain event, you know, just every single person feeling like they had a stake in it. You know, you had everyone pulled together there, and that's because, you know, it is such a sporting country, the most sporting country. Yeah, love sports more than any other, I think.
Looking at that bid, and by the way, for everybody listening, we're having a little bit of audio fading in and out. If there's any problems, I'll let Chuck know. Just bear with us. Looking at that Cutter bid, there were some other things I thought were curious, even beyond the idea that they won. I feel like there was a lot of, even at the time, there was some pie in the sky ideas for how we're going to build these stadiums and what we're going to do about the weather. You write, Qatar in the summer isn't just 110 degrees. It isn't just the desert. It's a muggy 110 degrees. It's brutal. Yet they were promising to have, quote, air-conditioned stadiums, even air-conditioned sidewalks outside air-conditioned stadiums, which you say would furnish the daydream of a world entirely air-conditioned someday. Just that part alone, we can hold this event in the summer and we're going to have air-conditioned sidewalks. Was that a tip-off that maybe this was a bad idea, or maybe the fix was in a little bit for them to win so handily?
I think that amount of concern going in, coupled with them winning so handily, yes, certainly gave people the idea that, you know, that sort of, oh, come on,
Right.
kind of
Because
approach, because the weather was a, you know, I remember writing a column where because I was working in Abu Dhabi then, and I supported the idea because I liked the idea of the World Cup coming to a region where it had never come before. I like when it brings together the different cultures, you know, and lets them kind of get a glimpse of each other more than they usually do up front, up close. And so, but I remember people wrote me disparaging, oh, come on, how can you endorse a World Cup in 50 degrees Celsius, you know, which is more than 110.
Right.
And, you know, in that area, and the United Arab Emirates is the same weather-wise, largely the same. We've called it the Persian Gulf always. They call it the Arabian Gulf. There's a dispute over what to call it. So, but it is that is the most awful weather from May to September that I've ever been in. You know, it may, you know, Las Vegas, think of Las Vegas when it's 115 or Phoenix or whatever. Very, very pleasant compared to this.
Oh yeah, the thing is, people don't understand. Humidity is the killer. It's like
Yes.
take the humidity in New Orleans, now add Las Vegas, sun essentially,
That's exactly
and
it.
lack of trees and shade, and see
Yeah.
how you're gonna feel. I'm curious because there was another little piece of the bid that I thought was a little bit crazy, and I'm wondering if they've walked this back at all, because they have been there has been talk of moving moving the whole event out of the summer, if it stays in Qatar, and moving it to the winter, even though that would conflict with, everybody's, national league, domestic league soccer schedules. It's kind of like the way the Winter Olympics conflicts with the NHL schedule. But they're talking about that now because, I mean, I guess this dream of air-conditioned sidewalks maybe isn't feasible after all. They also promised that they were going to deconstruct 9 of the 12 stadiums after the 2022 World Cup and ship them to countries in need. And I hate to snicker, but like on every level, that seems bizarre to me. Like, how are you going to deconstruct a stadium, and what qualifies as a country in need, and specifically in need of a soccer stadium?
Well, there are lots of countries around that have dilap that love soccer that have dilapidated stadiums. You know, whether there would be some sort of application process for that, I didn't know. What you do get used to in that region, with Dubai sitting there, and the two of them are very competitive with each other as well, and then Bahrain as well, which has a Formula One race. You get used to that amount of money, and projects like that come to seem very realistic, very feasible, plausible. You know, Abu Dhabi has this NYU and this whole island that they've made with NYU branch and the Louvre and a maritime museum that they're going to have, and a Guggenheim. And you get used to these great big shiny
Grandiose,
things.
right.
Yeah, so living there at that point, I did kind of, yeah, definitely look at that crazy idea and go, wow, that's great.
Maybe it's possible. Maybe we can put a stadium on the moon while we're at it.
I
I
think
mean,
it's more feasible than the, I think they would tear them down,
right.
put them on big ships and send them to, to wherever. So.
I had to ask because I just thought that was really crazy. But you were living in the region at the time, like you said. What was it like there when the bid was awarded? Were people, again, I know you can't speak for everyone in the region, but the general feeling was it just excitement? We got this. Was it, oh, this is crazy that we're getting this, or wow, we really suckered people, or what was the feeling from people you knew?
I
Was it
think it's
all over the place?
no, I think it's interesting when you look at the celebrations of that, vote, when the envelope is opened. If you look carefully in the celebrations, there aren't that many people in them, and that doesn't mean that if Spain won, there would be a square full of people in Madrid. That might not be all that much bigger, but what you do have there with those with Qatar is a country so small that something like even as sweeping as that doesn't seem that sweeping. There just aren't that many people, period, to who would get excited about it. Because obviously, if you're living there and working there, and you're, I know Canadians who live there. I knew Brazilian who lived there, just people I m met along the way. You're not going to get excited about it in the way that you would in your homeland. And when a population of guests dwarfs the population of citizens by 4 to 1, 4.5 to 1, in the, or 5 to 1, depending on what estimate,
It's like here, it's like where I live here in DC. We're a transient city. But it's not, obviously it's not really like that, but it's kind of that idea. I think what you're saying is this sort of, you talked about Australia and everyone there feeling very invested in this, the 2000 Olympics and having a sense of pride in it. Maybe you're not going to find that as much in a place like Qatar.
You're going to find a wee fraction of it,
Right.
you bring up Australia. I mean, they would stage the World Cup, I dare say, at least as well or better than anyone, but it would be so galvanized. And you're talking about a pretty small population there compared to us. They're only 22 million or something like that, Australia. But then then you go from there to Qatar down to a few hundred thousand people who are really going to be proud of this, and
I
who.
mean, this is like Rhode Island getting the World Cup, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah.
Rhode Island might be bigger. I'm not sure. Maybe Delaware. I'm trying to think of the comparable here in the States. But you did feel though that there would be some potentially positive things about trying to hold the World Cup in Qatar. Even in the middle of summer, like you said, you supported the bid at the time. You liked the idea of cultures intermixing. Do you think it can, if it stays there, do some good for the region?
I think it can do. The first thing I think of when you ask that is it can do some good for the guest workers there who have conditions in many of those countries, several of those countries, which would and do appall us as Westerners, as Americans, as Canadians, as Europeans. I think that could be the very best, byproduct, most meaningful one of it. There's been pressure on.
So there's been pressure on Qatar.
In these, I would see this in Abu Dhabi all the time, this great level of heat and humidity. And these construction workers are just out there all day, and you don't know kind of, how many breaks they get or so on. So, that, and then on the other side of that is. You get a real view of the world economy because many of these people make wages that are again shocking to us, but still some, in their homelands, they'll tell you. I knew many of them. I befriended many of them. They would t tell you that they would, they were building houses in their home for their families in their homelands that they could have never built if they stayed there. So it's like most things, it's complicated.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing where if people are willing to do something and getting something out of it, but they can still be exploited at the same time. And I feel like that's part of what we see. But what we also see, and this is very serious, and again, you rightly labeled this as really the worst part of what's happening with the Qatar World Cup bid and award, isn't necessarily the bribery scandal. It is this treatment of these young migrant workers. They're largely from Nepal, India. Very poor, brought in to build the stadiums and build everything else, like you said, all the other sort of crazy projects that we see there that money can afford. We've seen some really good investigative reporting on this. These people are dying.
Yeah,
It's
there's.
not just that they're out working in the heat. They're being kept in terrible working and living conditions. It's a lot of times for less money than promised, even if they're getting enough money to send some back home. You see these things where their passports are literally taken away from them, and they're almost like in prison. They're almost like modern day, maybe slaves isn't the right word, but indentured servants. There's a lot of sort of very questionable things going on, and people are actually dying as well in the construction. Again, you said you lived there, you befriended some of these people. Did you when Qatar won the bid, did you think to yourself, this might become a big problem?
Actually, to my discredit, I didn't, and it was because of going to so many. It was there. It was already familiar by then that the region had, through its money, attained so many sporting events. And on the other side, you're accustomed to the regular debate, the more important one, of course, about the conditions for the guest workers. I don't think I had really thought enough about the melding of the two before this happened. So then, when The Guardian, to its huge credit, what stationed there and did reporting on it, there was almost this, oh, of course, element to it. I did think that in the areas where the West and the Middle East clash culturally, that the World Cup might help. I did think that. And we were debating this into the night with Americans who thought it was terrible, who, of course, wanted the U.S. to win, American soccer fans. And so, and I, my point would be, well, when the two cultures mingle, ours does tend to prevail. Hip hop enormous among the young people, American hip hop,
Right. So
enormous amount.
I mean, the American pop culture does tend to be, the thing that wins out across the world. Like you said, when cultures sort of mingle and collide and compete.
And in the meaningful way of, of labor situation, the pressure has been on to improve this, and I don't know, it's such an opaque regime, which is, always going to be a problem, but there's been real pressure on them to try to make reforms, and they've at least made a show of trying to make reforms in this situation. I kind of wanted to see what it was really like, so I lived with a guy for 7 months
Really?
in Dubai who well, it came about because I knew him through a friend, and he was going to lose his apartment and go to jail because you're not allowed to be in debt there. And his wife had been living there, and she had left and gone back to the Philippines, which is one of the five main countries where the workers come from. And but the hotel where he worked, he had a good job, not a dangerous one like these. But the hotel where he worked, they had his passport the whole time, and he couldn't leave. And I just found this, really, it was a very upfront view of what a hard, hard world it usually is, and how we probably in our lives have been privy to the softer side of it, frankly.
Sure. I mean, that's, like you said, I mean, even you don't necessarily have to have a backbreaking job to be in a really difficult and a situation that we probably wouldn't accept here in the United States in terms of the employer keeping your passport. If you're in debt, you go to jail according to the laws of the country. I mean, those are, we have bankruptcy, We don't have debtors' prisons anymore. At least we try not to. I mean, there are some ways in which our law still works that way, but for the most part, we've tried to avoid those kinds of outcomes, and it seems maybe other parts of the world, I guess, are in a different place in sort of the developmental curve when it comes to that.
Yeah, I mean, our newspaper in Abu Dhabi wrote an editorial one time, saying, "Come on, gently, let's revisit this debt prison idea." For one thing, putting someone in prison is not a very good way to attempt to collect the debt.
No, it's not actually. It's not a lot of economic opportunity to make a killing in prison unless you can corner the market on, on heroin, shanks, and cigarettes. That I wonder if with the migrant worker issue, with the guest worker issue, however you, whatever the right term is, you said, maybe it's good, at least because of the World Cup bid. There has been now outside attention focused on this as a problem, focused on the abuses, focused on the deaths, focused on the things that we find appalling, essentially. And that maybe because of that, whether it's international pressure or in shame or embarrassment or wanting to keep the event, there will be some positive reforms. Maybe things will get better for some of these workers. Do you think that that is or really will happen, or do you think there'll be sort of a little bit of sanitizing for show, but the underlying system won't change?
I would say, oh boy, I do believe that when the pressure mounts, that changes do come. I don't want to be too overly optimistic, but I do think there's a chance. So
Now, is
as long
it,
as there's a chance,
can I ask you, in terms of where this comes from, is it simply a straight economic thing? It's like we've seen throughout human history. They're the really wealthy and powerful, have the money to do this, and so they kind of get away with it, and that's just how it is. Unless you have like strong legal protections and more economic equality and things like that, you will always have sort of the strong preying on the weak. I mean, is it something as simple as that, or is there are there other cultural factors here? Is there a factor of these people are from somewhere else, therefore, you don't look at them the same way, and I can exploit them? I mean, it's, we've had that here. Look, here in America, it's no You look at our own history. I mean, we have a series of defining different ethnic groups usually as the other, and then exploiting them, whether it's the worst case scenario, something like slavery, or even in the modern time, you've got immigrant workers from Mexico who are not treated well still. They're not enslaved. Well, every now and then you actually do find a case of something that very much approaches slavery, at the Florida produce farms or things like that, and that are really shocking. But we have that here too, still to an extent, and we have that in our history. Is it similar there? Is there something else going on culturally? Is there something we're missing?
I think it really does largely, almost entirely, boil down to what you said about that's the way economics work. If you don't keep an eye on them, that the but the other there's a twist to that, which is that for many, and it's really five countries that we're talking about: the Philippines, Nepal. I'm sorry, it's six. The Philippines, Bangladesh, India, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Nepal, with Nepal probably the least actually of those six, and heavily Bangladesh and India, I would say. So you see them, and the Philippines. I saw somewhere where 12% of the people living in the UAE are Filipino. So that's we would do stories on Manny Pacquiao there all the time as if he was were our local. To some degree, and in the right circumstance, those people coming from those countries do think that it's worth the trip. They don't, when they talk later, maybe if they move back and you see them later and they talk about their experience in the Middle East, they might say, oh, I had a, they might say that it was worth it for them. They might also say that it was horrible and I was bored to death and I worked all the time and I hated it. And many times if you befriend them or they befriend you and you're American or whatever, they will ask for help in trying to get them a visa to the US, which is very, very hard to do for much of the world. So there is an element though of, hey, this works for me. Hey, I talked to a lot of Pakistanis driving taxis in the UAE will say, oh, I've been here 10, 15 years. I go home once every year or once every 2 years, depending on the deal, for 2 months. I see my family then, and then I come back here and I make money and I send it home. So I don't want to say that it's entirely an exploitation, even though by in my American mind, it's very much one. But there's terrible stories of nannies, who come to cook for families and are made to work for, 18 hours a day. And if you go to any airport, most any airport, say in Asia, in South Asia, and you look in the waiting gates, you'll see these workers coming. They're preparing the flight to Dubai or the flight to Abu Dhabi or the flight to Doha in Qatar. They're coming and you can see them, you can recognize them, that after a while they're easily, they make groups, new groups of friends, and they hug each other at the airport when one of them goes home. It becomes a whole familiar element, cultural element that's going on in that part of the world, this area with huge amounts of money because of what's under the ground, and then these areas that don't have that same thing under the ground and therefore fly in to do all the toil for these areas that have.
I understand where you're coming from with that, and I think you're right. It's sort of like this fundamental resource and economic disconnect that sort of fuels a lot of this.
Yes.
I want to get back really quick to bid bribery, because I don't, maybe in defense of Qatar or even just an acknowledgement of the larger context here, this is not the first rodeo we've seen when it comes to a major sporting event and bid bribery. We
Well,
see it's
we
we
should note that our own country has one of the most famous
exactly.
cases.
Exactly. We see this all the time. We saw it in Nagano, like you said, famously with Salt Lake City. That actually launched Mitt Romney's permanent presidential campaign, with
It
him
sure
coming in
did.
to quote unquote clean up and right the ship there. Allegedly, we saw this with Beijing. We've seen so much of it, these things over the years. I wrote a piece last month for us. It was half tongue in cheek, but half not, saying that we should basically bring all this bribery above board and just make a reality show out of it, that it would be more entertaining and more honest. But the point I was really trying to make is that I wasn't sure if we would ever actually be able to sort of get rid of this. That there's just too much, like you said, there's so much money involved. There's too much money to be made. And I think even more so, sports fans themselves, I'm not convinced they ultimately really care that much about this. Like, I think what they care about is being able to watch the games on TV. And I also think the TV networks and the sponsors and the advertisers that are putting up all this cash to broadcast, which then goes into the pockets of FIFA and goes in the pockets of these federations, and is the money that is lubricating this system of graft and corruption. I don't think they really care either. As long as those fans are watching, and as long as they can go out and buy the products being advertised.
And in the end, what is the big harm? I mean, obviously, I'd like the system to be fair. Although maybe I'm on the I'd like all the sporting events just to go to Australia, but and I'm not Australian, but at the end, like if you look at so many of these studies done on oil-rich countries with large poverty issues, where the corruption at the top winds up harming the population at large.
There's the re
There,
they call it the resource curse.
yeah, there's a harm in that corruption, and there's a harm in lots of corruptions in it. But what is the big harm in this corruption? Is there really, can we really pinpoint a big harm in, oh, okay, so the World Cup, went to Qatar in 2020 for 2022. One of the biggest complaints I heard was people worried that they wouldn't be able to drink openly beer the way that, the way that one does at most World Cups and the way that people are about to at this World Cup this
So yeah,
month. I
so
mean,
because it's a Islamic country, you're not gonna be able to drink beer. That's the major harm that's gonna happen from this being there.
that was the thing discussed the most beyond the weather.
I mean
So,
that's on the spectrum of harm, that's pretty far to the side of harmless. I'm gonna throw a potential harm out there if you because again to kind of go big picture with this. We have these problems in Qatar. You have these ongoing protests in Brazil over the World Cup that's starting there in a couple of days, and over the 2016 Olympics. They're protesting, and here's where I think a potential harm comes in. The idea of spending all this public money on these big stadiums, on these giant white elephants that always seem to end up rotting and being useless after 2 weeks. Instead of on things the public actually needs, like schools, housing, infrastructure, stuff government usually spends its money on, spends the public's money on, in theory. You actually see New York, Philadelphia, quite a number of other cities internationally are actually withdrawing or not bidding on upcoming Olympic Games. I think maybe the public and even politicians are starting to understand that this isn't necessarily a good deal a lot of times to host these events. You end up, like I said, what happened in Athens. You're broke. You got all these dilapidated, useless stadiums. So I do think there could be harm in terms of that. Do you think that that's a legitimate way to look at it? Like there is a harm maybe sometimes in winning these bids. If corruption sends it to your country, and your country really isn't in a position to pay for this, or really could be spending that money on something better.
Yeah, oh yeah, I do. And I think this Brazilian World Cup might be the most fascinating sporting event ever because of this, because it seems to be where we're going to have this big discussion about the amount of, money, the direction that where the money is spent. That's, I would separate that from the bidding process itself, and then once the bid is awarded, how is the money spent and how corrupt? That's the only thing different. I would separate those two issues.
You're right, because we saw a lot of I don't know if there were allegations of corruption in the bid for the Olympics going to Sochi, but there were huge allegations and evidence of corruption in terms of how Russian public money was spent on
Yes.
staging those games.
And don't forget that the World Cup in between Brazil and Qatar
Is in
is
Russia.
yeah, so.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point because you talk about Qatar, you talk about Russia, and I'm going to tie in something domestically here in a second. Those are, how do we say, those are autocratic regimes, I would say, autocratic countries. That maybe that's a mild way to put it. I wonder if the future of building these stadiums, bidding on these events, wanting to do this essentially, is with finding, if you're FIFA, you're the Olympics, you got to find a willing dictator or autocrat government that's going to say, like, hey, yeah, come on in. We'll build all this stuff. We have the power to do that. Maybe that's not in the public interest, but the public doesn't have much say here. And I actually also bring that up because here, like I said, domestically in the States, Cobb County, Georgia, I don't know if you've been following this. I know you've been traveling around the globe the last couple of months. They're building a new stadium for the Atlanta Braves. And public officials there, the Cobb County commissioners, they basically shut the public out of the decision to fund this stadium. Probably because the public would have said no. I mean, is that the future of stadium and big event financing? Is find a willing dictator or an autocratic sucker to do this?
I'm not sure. I used to have, I do have friends in Seattle who used to complain about the same thing. Well, we voted no. I'd have to go back and look at that, but they'd say we voted no for a stadium, and then they shoveled it to us anyway,
Right.
And is it the future? It has to be, doesn't it? At some point, this has to turn. And what I've always wondered about this, or for a while I've wondered, is why does all, and this happened with Sochi, it happened with Beijing, London to some degree. Why does all this money have to be spent on outdoing the last people in terms of a ceremony or in
Right.
terms of, and then, so Brazil, what is it, 12 stadiums? Why not six? Why not, can you do a World Cup in six? I don't know. Maybe you need a 32 team World Cup, you need 12, you
I don't
know.
I was watching something about that the other night, and even if the number of stadiums is necessary, I mean, there's one stadium, they're building it in the middle of the Amazon. They have to float the parts down the river. I mean, what, and then as soon as this World Cup's over, it's going to be completely useless being there. Completely. Nobody has, and they're like, well, we might have a few concerts here. And it's like, come on. What are you going to do? Have Colonel Kurt show up for a concert? Like, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
And the bid that's going to be really interesting about this, if it's still going, I haven't checked lately because they've been dropping out, but Oslo, Norway, 2022 Winter Olympics, which is going to be decided next in the summer of 15, $3 billion. That's it.
Wow.
We're not spending more than 3 billion. That's it. Even and I think even at that, the public is not
They're not
really
totally
excited
happy with
about.
that, right?
Even though we're talking about another country that had one of the greatest, most raved about successful Olympics in history, the '94 Lillehammer,
Right, and the
was it?
Norwegians love Winter Olympic sports too. I mean, they're good at them. They play them. They perform in them. I'm pretty sure in Sochi we talked about that, right? And we talked
I think
about
it's going
the.
to be, we're talking about Putin spent supposedly 51 billion,
Amazing.
and now we're talking about three, and I think Salt Lake cost 2 billion.
It did, and that
So,
was way over budget. And people thought that was a ridiculous amount of money, and there was a lot of federal subsidy for it. And I think that 2 billion also includes, like, the tremendous extra money they pumped into security because that was post 9/11, and everybody was really, really paranoid. Even though it was in Salt Lake.
So when is it going to stop? It's going to and maybe reverse course. And I actually thought I was disappointed. I thought London could reverse the course of the world with some sort of wry humor and irony maybe in their opening ceremony. And I love their opening ceremony, but but I thought maybe they were the ones that could turn it around and make it really small, just as a statement,
Yeah.
and
When a push comes to shove, don't count on that, though.
but you're right when you are talking about, and I think in the whole world in general, this is just one example of a whole discussion that's going to carry the world for a while on the income gap and the difference in that and when you're talking about free societies such as Brazil, where the public has a say and a vote, yeah, I think you're right. It's about the autocratic part of it that that's who, those are going to be the people who can pull it off without having a lot of unrest,
Right. I'm glad you brought up the idea of income gap because I want to get you out of here on one last question. Again, it's kind of a big picture thing. Maybe income gap's the wrong word. Maybe wealth inequality is really, I mean, it's kind of the
That's
big
right.
thing we're talking about now. And that's really what it is. Something I noticed about the bribery, alleged bribery, excuse me, for the Qatar bid, is that if you kind of boiled it down, what it really seemed to involve was, as you mentioned earlier, these rich Middle East oil people, who have this resource under the ground, essentially paying off people from much poorer soccer federations around the world, many of them from Africa, where you don't, in some parts of Africa, you have these resources under the ground, many places you don't. And now it wasn't everybody, because over here in North America we had super corrupt Jack Wagner, who apparently was also getting payoffs. So he's a podcast subject all his own. But it was largely Africa, and I felt like this parallels not only what we just talked about with some of the guest worker issues. Again, we're talking about Africans there, but we're talking about people again from sort of more impoverished countries. But also, I mentioned match fixing at the top of the podcast. Those match fixing scandals are basically tend to involve payoffs from these, wealthy Southeast Asian gambling syndicates and fixers to bureaucrats and referees in South Africa, and sort of again, a place where those bureaucrats as referees don't have a lot of money. So that's my rambling way of wheeling up this question, which is, you've traveled everywhere. Is what we are calling corruption in all this actually more just a reflection of the tremendous wealth disparity that we have in this world? And here in America, even, should we really be wagging our fingers at vote buying of any kind when in our own political campaigns, we're spending billions on advertising and we spend billions on lobbying our politicians? Is this all sort of the same kind of thing, just different ways of doing it?
Yes, but you could say, and you could also say, well, this is the way the world works, and the way that it's always worked, and it's unsurprising for that, for that reason. It's the way things are done. So you could say that, that the I just went to I went to. And South Africa. So I was listening to people talk about, all the various levels of, of corruption or and then the various levels of cynicism that you heard there. And that's when you hear these stories, that's why, even though it's the way the world works, I think there's a real value in at least trying to fight it, and at least trying to expose it and to, I think there would be if these Sunday Times of London millions of emails get hard verification, I think there would be great value in taking that World Cup away and giving it to someone else.
How, do you think it's a realistic possibility?
I
That might
don't.
actually happen? No.
I don't. But maybe I'm being too cynical in that regard. I think there might be too much tied up in it, even by now, 8 years out. I know there was once a World Cup taken away from Colombia, a place I've spent a lot of time and love very much, because of, and it was taken away, but there because of the, I think as I recall, I'd have to go back and read that again, both economic and concern. It was in the 80s, the one that went to
Right.
Mexico
So there was a lot of
in
concern probably over
1986.
violence, drug violence, I'd imagine,
Right,
at that point.
right. But I think it's hard. Yes, exactly. But I think it's harder. Yeah, and Colombia's, 100 times say improved over that phase of its
Oh, I mean,
history.
that was the era where, you had Pablo Escobar. He had like his own mechanized tank division laying siege to the Colombian Supreme Court building. I mean, it was insane. Like that, yeah, it's a lot better now than that.
So, but that was, I guess, 1983 or 84, where they decided to move that 86 World Cup to Mexico, which had just had one in 1970. So, what I wonder with Qatar is it a lot harder now in the 21st century with so much corporate money tied in and so
Right.
on to move these things? And my guess would be yes, but I don't know. But I would think it's harder now to pry one out of a place which has been awarded it for, 3.5 years ago.
I mean,
And
I'm, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I'm even more cynical, and my thought is like, it'll move if moving means, preserving the jobs of whoever in FIFA is all in on knowing about this or in on the take, that it will keep them from getting exposed and losing their job, then they'll move it. Otherwise, they won't. That's kind of my take on it. Like, if it's a push comes to shove situation, where the people who know where all the bodies are buried are risk being exposed, and they can get out of that exposure and hang on to what they've got, and this includes Sepp Blatter, then it'll move. If they can smooth this over. Identify a few people. You guys are the bad apples. Get rid of them. Act like, we've taken care of this. We investigated. Problem solved. Dust off their hands and keep it there. That's what'll happen. Because that's usually how the world works. That's how the world usually works.
Yeah, I guess it also could move as maybe a power play between two people in FIFA. Who
That's
knows?
right.
You
That's right.
know.
There are a lot of internal FIFA politics. Actually, our own Aaron Gordon wrote a little bit about that today.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
it's funny, the guy who is the Qatari, who's kind of at the center of allegedly setting up these bribes and rigging the bid, until recently, wasn't he Sepp Blatter's big rival to become
Yes.
FIFA president? That's pretty interesting. You almost wonder if some of this is getting out because Sepp Blatter is cutting this guy off at the knees.
Well, and people thought Sepp Blatter voted for the United States. I don't know if that's true, but nobody knows if that's true because
It's all secret.
yeah.
Star
So
Chamber.
it kind of reminded me, in a way, because Qatar's reaction is, well, this guy was not involved in our bid. He's just a FIFA executive who lives in our very small country, and
He's just a guy. We don't know. I mean,
just a guy with tons of money who lives in
right.
our, tiny country. So their response, I found it really weak. Well, this guy wasn't part of our organization,
He didn't have an official title, therefore nothing untoward is happening. It's like, look, Cutter, like, we all understand how bagmen work. They're usually not on the official payroll. That's part of the point of having a bagman, is that you can have plausible deniability.
Right. He just happens to be a fellow citizen in a thimble full of, citizens in the world who are from our from our have our nationality, who also holds a major executive post in the organization that grants.
It's like, what are the
It was
odds of this happening? Actually, the odds are
very
pretty
weak.
good. The odds are pretty high, actually. Sorry.
I actually felt sorry for them from a PR standpoint.
From a PR standpoint, you could definitely feel sorry for them. Look, Chuck Culpepper, thank you so much for coming on. Everybody listening, thanks for bearing with a couple of these Skype drops here. We've been fading a little bit in and out once in a while. Before we go, how can people find you online and on Twitter?
On Twitter, it's Chuck Culpepper one, the numeral one, and online at sportsonearth.com.
That's right, sportsonearth.com, where this broadcast is originating from. Chuck, thanks so much. Now joining us to talk about the other big bad recent FIFA story, match fixing, is another friend of the podcast, Brian Toohey. He is the author of two books. One, The Fix Is In, which deals with sports conspiracy theories and fixing, and the other, Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI, which is pretty much self-explanatory. And like I said earlier, Brian also writes a sports conspiracyologist column for Sports on Earth. Brian, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Patrick. Glad to be here.
Terrific. Oh, no, it's always a pleasure. Let's get right into it. New York Times, two-part series over the weekend. They detailed match fixing ahead of the last World Cup, 2010, in South Africa. It's a crazy story. I encourage everyone listening to go read all of it for the details. But just sort of in a nutshell, they basically described how a huge Asian match fixing syndicate create a front company that would basically choose and assign referees to international soccer matches. And according to an internal investigative report by FIFA itself, a report that went unreleased, but that the Times got their hands on, fixers use this system to apparently manipulate, quote, at least five matches and possibly more, unquote, in South Africa ahead of the last World Cup. They also reported that as many as 15 matches were targets, including a game between the U.S. and Australia. Now, Brian, I know you read the Times story. This is right in your wheelhouse. In any way, were you surprised by it? And how does it compare to all the other reports we've seen and you've written about involving match fixing and international soccer as a whole?
Well, it wasn't surprising at all because I think more astute people who have kind of followed this whole match fixing catastrophe that's really happened to soccer over the past probably 5 to 10 years knew about this story, in all honesty. I mean, what Declan wrote about in the New York Times actually wasn't new information to me, in all honesty.
And that's Declan Hill, the main writer on these stories, who we got to give him credit. He's like kind of the guy in investigative journalism that's been front and center
Oh, and this match fixing thing by far,
yeah,
like, he
exposing
is.
match fixing. He is like the world expert on this.
I mean, I think what really made the New York Times piece more interesting is they got the internal FIFA documents that kind of proved all this. But like I said, it was kind of a known thing. It was known that match fixers had gotten to those prelim games for the World Cup in 2010. And I think what's really interesting about it is how brazen these match fixers are.
I'm so glad you said that. That is exactly what blew my mind. I want to read just a tiny excerpt from the New York Times story because I think it will give everybody an idea of when we say brazen, we mean brazen. So here goes. Here's how the Times lays it out. This is the scene they describe. A soccer referee named Ibrahim Chaibu walked into a bank in a small South African city carrying a bag filled with as much as $100,000 in $100 bills. This is according to another referee who was traveling with him. The deposit was so large that a bank employee gave this guy a gift of commemorative coins bearing the likeness of Nelson Mandela. Later that same night, this is back in May 2010, he ref an exhibition match between South Africa and Guatemala right before the World Cup. And it says, even to the casual fan, his calls were suspicious. He called two penalties for handballs, even though the ball went nowhere near the player's hands. He also was chosen to work this match by a company based in Singapore, as I mentioned earlier, that was a front for a notorious match rigging syndicate. I mean, how brazen do you have to get to go to the bank on that day with a big sack of cash, another referee with you, and then call like two obvious calls that even fans can tell are BS? I mean, what does it say? Look, I think we all suspect that this happens, but what does it say when you have so little fear almost of getting caught that you could do it so openly?
Well, I think that it speaks to how widespread it has become. And I think that's the scary aspect of it all. Is like you say, I mean, you would think a smart person who was involved in match fixing wouldn't do what that referee did. But yet, when these guys based in Singapore and the Far East are literally recruiting referees, players, even coaches around the world, mainly from teams that really don't have a lot of money to support their soccer entities, it's just very easy for them to do, and it's very easy apparently for them to get away with it.
And they don't sound really afraid of getting caught or getting punished, do they?
No, and that's part of the thing is FIFA, I don't think, has for a long time was not doing the job in terms of monitoring their own integrity and the integrity of their matches and their referees and their players. And they kind of, in a way, left it to, Interpol and Europol and these more FBI-type organizations around the world. And in all honesty, it's not, at the forefront of criminality match fixing.
Right, that's not, they've got a lot of other things to be
Yeah, there's a lot
investigating.
more important things to deal with than, geez, who fixed the soccer match or who didn't fix the soccer match. And that's part of the issue, too, I think, in match fixing in general, is the fact of proving what happened. I mean, who's willing to look into this? How many journalists are willing to look into this? How many law enforcement agencies are willing to look into this? And what can you prove if you're a fan sitting at home saying, boy, that was a horrible call. Like, this guy made two horrible, horrible handball calls in this match that's referenced, but prove that he did it intentionally. I mean, that's a completely different, aspect is to get, follow the path of the money, where it came from, who it got to, where it came from, and then it led to this call in this match. That's not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not. I mean, even if they are like doing it brazenly and walking around with sacks of cash, that's still hard to do.
Yeah, exactly. To get it to a point of being able to convict a guy of it, that's a huge thing to do. I mean, he could make up any excuse. So I got this money from who knows where. I found it, underneath a tree. I mean,
Well,
whatever.
let's you know. I know you covered soccer match fixing in a chapter of one of your books. I know you talked pretty extensively with Declan Hill. I know he was very helpful to you in sort of understanding how things work. Really quickly, break down for me the elements of a fix. If I say, Brian, welcome to the syndicate. You're working for us now. Go out there and fix some matches. What are you going to look for? What do you need for it to happen? What are you looking for in terms of referees, teams, players, national federations? How do you do it?
I think there's two ways to go. One way is these match fixers have been targeting there's like an under 17 World Cup, and I think there's an under 20 World Cup where the players have to be under that certain age. And in one aspect, these match fixers will go after these young kids, much like I think people would do in college basketball or football here in the United States, guys who are not making any money doing what they're doing, who want to become professionals. And saying, look, here, I'll give you $5,000, I'll give you $10,000, you fix this match for me. And they get their hooks into these players at a really young age and do it that way. The other way is, from what Declan really writes about and talks about, is they go after older players and older referees who are on their way out of the game, who maybe did make a lot of money during their career, but like we've seen again in American sports, guys who blow through a lot of money during their career as well. And now see the end and realize, geez, I don't have any money in the bank. Maybe I can make some extra money fixing matches. And here come these guys. And these guys approach them all over the place, apparently. I mean, they know the hotels these players stay at. They know where they train. They know where they practice. And they show up there and just horn right in and say, hey, would you be interested in doing this? I mean, it doesn't sound like it's a very underhanded approach. It sounds like it's a very front and center, like, hi, my name's so and so. Would you like to make some money fixing the match with me?
Here's a
That's
bag of
what they do.
cash. Would you
Yeah,
like
it's a bag of
this
cash.
bag?
Let's get at
Right,
it, you know?
right. Who here likes money?
And one of the things, too, they do target, they won't necessarily go after, Team USA because a lot of these guys do have money and they come from pretty good backgrounds. They will go after more teams and players from, places like Ghana and Africa and, more third world countries where a little bit of money may go a very long way in getting a player to do what you want him to do.
Right. I mean, that's in the Times report. One of the main fixers. He actually, again, this is how brazen it is. He wrote a memoir that was published in April. And in his memoir, he claimed that he bribed an official in South Africa to fix matches. This is international friendlies again before the World Cup. And the bribe was $60,000 to $75,000 a match, which is a lot of money. It also seems like a relatively small amount of money, given that these fixtures claim they're making millions on these fixed matches. So for them, it's a great investment.
Oh, it's an incredible return on the money. Yeah, if you can get a referee for 60 grand and you can make $1 million on a bet, yeah, you'd do that all day long.
I can't do that in the stock market, even if I had insider trading tips like Phil Mickelson. I don't think I'd make that much. I'm sorry, Phil. We don't alleged insider trading. We don't really know. Shouldn't say that. Where's the money coming from? We talk about the fact that they can make millions on a fix. Where is this money coming from? What is the size and scope of this international sports betting, and in this case, soccer betting market that is driving this corruption, that's driving the fixing? What are we talking about here in terms of size, scope, the parts of the world involved, how many people are betting, the amounts of money they're putting down? Well, do we have a handle on this industry? I assume most of it's illegal, not above board.
No, it doesn't seem like anybody has a handle on really how much money is out there because of so much being it involved in the illegal underground gambling world. A lot of it in the Far East, in Singapore and China, Hong Kong, those places, it's really illegal. And one of the things these fixtures do allow the referees and players to actually bet into these illegal markets because it is an underground market. It's not like you can, just make a phone call and get the guy you want. You have to have the connection to find that illegal market and get into it to bet into it. And there's been estimates that perhaps as much as $1 trillion,
$1 trillion.
a
That's
trillion
huge. Wow.
is running through these illegal organized crime bookmakers in the Far East. But at the same time, the game fixers are betting in the legal markets. They are betting legally in Europe, in England. Las Vegas takes bets on these soccer matches, and they're getting pretty big returns on these soccer matches in Las Vegas as well. And the offshore sports books, that are quasi legal here in the United States, they take a lot of money in on soccer matches. So, there's money being bet literally around the globe, and a lot of it is illegal, some of it is legal. And that's the problem, is FIFA says, well, we have this early warning system and we're monitoring the betting that's going on, but they're only monitoring the legal betting system in England, in Europe, and maybe in some of the offshore sports books, but that's clearly not telling them the full story. What's going on? The real money, the real fixing is coming from these illegal entities in Singapore and elsewhere, which no one is watching and no one can watch.
You mentioned FIFA, and they have like an early warning system. They are trying to look at the betting lines. I know other leagues do this too, other organizations, not just FIFA. I think all sports at this point at least have one person keeping an eye on this stuff in
Yeah, because
contact with
tennis does the same thing. Cricket has the same thing. Even I think in the United States, supposedly the NFL, the NBA monitor their lines as well.
And not just the legal lines, but historically the NFL. It was reported used to monitor sort of the underground lines as well,
Oh, yeah.
which I'm sure I'm pretty confident most of these leagues do or have done or will do. It just seems like common sense. Obviously, it's generally not in their interest to have their games be fixed. It doesn't look good for their business model. But getting back to FIFA specifically, and maybe the limitations of what they're doing to combat this, or get a handle on it, or police it, the Times says that its report raises serious questions about the vulnerability of the upcoming World Cup itself to match fixing. So now we're not just talking about friendlies. Before, we're not talking about exhibitions. We're talking about the big show. Do you think that the cup itself is vulnerable to this?
Certainly. Oh, Declan Hill, again, going back to his research, he when he wrote his book called The Fix, Soccer and Organized Crime, which came out, I want to say around 2008, he talked about would have been in the 2006 World Cup watching, I think it was Ghana. He claimed he watched the match fixtures fix one of Ghana's matches in the World Cup.
Wow, in the cup. So what,
And he
that, I
wrote
mean,
about it in the book, yeah.
now is it was this do you know if was it through bribing players or was it through bribing referees, a mix of the both of the above?
I want to say it was through the players, but it's been a while since I've read the book, so I'm not 100% sure. But he tells the whole story in the book. And
Wow.
you can go back and
Sure.
look at some other World Cups as well where there's been suspect referee performance, even like the one that was held in South Korea, that there was questions about the referees and giving specific calls to the Korean team. Now, that may have not been because of gambling. That may have been quote unquote field advantage. But it's still, there's been a lot of questionable things that have happened in the World Cup. And the thing that bothers me is, if this is the biggest sporting event in the world, bigger than the Olympics, and these guys can get in and fix matches here, well, then nothing is safe.
No, I agree with you. And speaking of the ability or the potential for fixing, talking to New York Times, a former FIFA official who was involved with security said that they have an investigative staff, currently has 6 investigators, have a docket of about 90 match-fixing cases worldwide. This guy said that FIFA needs at least 10 full-time investigators and should have, probably have 2 offices at least in each of its 6 international confederations. But like I said, they've got 6 investigators. They don't have offices everywhere. They're not 2 offices everywhere.
Well, 6
even to me, 10 seems small, but like
I was about to say, yeah, for the entire world, 6 is nothing.
Right, and even,
I mean,
and
I don't
even
think
10 seems small.
6 guys could investigate, you know, the NFL.
That's a good point. I agree with you. And that leads to my question, which is, I'm sure FIFA says the right things publicly, but if this is the small amount of resources they're actually devoting to, like, not even stopping this problem, but just getting a handle on it, does that indicate that they don't really care about this problem as much as they might say they do?
I think that's part of it. I mean, I think a part of it is lip service. It's a PR move that says, hey, we have investigators. We're doing our due diligence. We're doing as much as we can to get to the bottom of this. But in a certain way, I mean, they need, because FIFA is a worldwide organization, they really do need help from every single country who has a soccer federation, who has investigators. And, you know, they need help from Singapore. They need help from England. They need really a coordinated effort from really almost every country in the world to really get a handle on all of this.
And they do need...
That's not an easy thing to do.
Right. And in their defense, even though, again, they should probably have more staff on this. They should probably... It sounds like they should take it more seriously. Ultimately, you know, they aren't police. They don't have subpoena power. They don't... They can't issue warrants. You know, there's a lot of things that the police can do that they can't wiretap people. They are going to need help from actual police too, and like you said, police have a lot of other important things to be looking into. Given all of that, in your mind, is there more that could or should be done to deal with this, or is this almost like a problem where looking for a way to deal with it is actually really hard, and maybe there isn't a good way to get a handle on it?
I don't know if you can, like you say, totally get a handle on the whole thing, because with so much of it coming from where it's illegal to bet, and yet people are betting, again, who knows, $500 billion, $1 trillion through that market, you can't monitor that. And that's, I think, the best defense these leagues may have is being able to monitor the betting action and see the crazy line movements and see the crazy odds and see where the money is coming from and who it's going to. And that may be one of the best ways to pinpoint this sort of activity.
Well, at least then you know where to investigate, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a great starting point. And some of that in Europe has led to arrests and has led to convictions, like in, you know, Italy. I mean, Serie A soccer.
We had a huge bunch of
15 years, yeah. And they were able to follow kind of the betting and get to the bottom of this. But when it's all coming out of places that no one's monitoring it, well, I don't know how you're going to get to the bottom of it. I mean, you can catch certain guys, and they have caught some supposed big wigs, but how much are they going to give up? How much are they going to turn over as state's evidence? And then
they'll just be someone else to take their place. It's probably like the drug war. You know, you get rid of one cartel leader, 3 more fight to take his place.
Especially when there's that much money involved. I mean, who would just let that money go? And, you know, okay, this works. We know how to fix matches. I mean, the only other thing you can do, supposedly, is, like, the education, that to teach these players, hey, this is wrong, this is bad, you can get in trouble doing this. But how far does that go? If somebody's, you know, offering you a bag of $100,000...
And you're poor.
And you're poor, what are you going to do? One soccer match for $100,000? Sounds like a pretty good deal.
Right. There's one other aspect of this, which is actually the fans, the bettors, the demand for this, the people that actually are pumping money and creating this market. I want to read you another small excerpt from the Times. This is from part 2 of their series, and I actually thought this was the single craziest thing in there. So let me read this to you. I think you know what I'm going to get at.
Yeah.
In February 2011, the betting syndicate, the East Asian betting syndicate, they orchestrated a tournament. They orchestrated a whole tournament. They invited the national teams of Estonia, Bulgaria, Bolivia, and Latvia to Turkey. This tournament's games were played in near-empty stadiums. They were not televised. And yet they attracted millions of dollars in bets on the Asian market. All 7 goals in the tournament were scored on penalty kicks, and all of those kicks were awarded by referees the syndicate had chosen and flown in. Okay, so pretty clearly this is WWE. Like, this is soccer WWE. Vince McMahon may as well have showed up with a folding chair at some point during one of these penalty kicks. And here's my question. If there are a lot of people out there, millions of dollars of bets, still willing to bet on an event that is so obviously set up for the express purpose of manipulating the very betting market that you're betting in, is there any hope of actually fixing this problem? I mean, or should we just shrug our shoulders? Because, like I said, if the bettors don't care that the fix is in, and they're the ones betting, how can the rest of us care?
That's a very good question because, like you say, the fix only matters in whatever sport it may be to those who fixed it. I mean, everybody else on the outside, it's still kind of a 50-50 proposition. Either team A is going to win or team B is going to win. You don't know. I mean, it's like professional wrestling, like you said. I mean, you may think, Hulk Hogan was going to win this match, but it doesn't necessarily mean Hulk Hogan will win that match, despite the fact that it's set up. So, yeah, if the bettors can't get a handle on it all, well, who else is going to care? One of the interesting things too about that story about the fake tournament, which they didn't mention in the Times article, but that same betting syndicate actually created a fake national team, believe it or
That's
not.
right, from Togo, right?
Yeah, from Togo, and they played a couple of matches, like one against Bahrain and
It's
somewhere else, and they
incredible.
were just instructed to take a dive, and yet nobody noticed that it was a fake national team.
We could have played on that team. I want in on this. I could have been on Togo's national team. Why not? I can't play soccer. I'm
Yeah,
perfect.
I could have been a bench guy. I would have been
Go
happy
out
to.
there and fall down. Here's your sack of cash. Thanks.
Yeah, I'd been happy to get a red card by punching some guy running past me. I mean, why not?
No, not a real punch, like an
True.
air punch. Remember, we don't want to actually have to be a legitimate call.
Yeah, I could throw a guy off a turnbuckle. How would that be?
Exactly. You can stomp your foot and as you're pretending to punch them, and they can make it look realistic. Last question here. I don't want to keep you too long today, and we ran a little over with Chuck, so we're running out of time here. Reading this article, knowing what you know, writing the books you've written, I know you follow this stuff. Would you yourself, if you were a betting man, and I'm pretty sure you're not, but if you were, or you were advising a friend, let's say me, to bet on the World Cup, would you say do it or don't do it?
Well, like you said, I would say go ahead and bet if that's what you're inclined to do. Just know that, again, somebody may be manipulating the game you were betting on. They may not be. And that's the thing. Like I said, you don't know as an outsider if the fix is in, who it's in for. So does it really matter? I mean, you could still guess right and pick the side that was fixed, or you could guess wrong and pick the side that was fixed against. But as an outside bettor, I mean, I think, for the most part, World Cup, when you look at, some of the major teams that are out there, that you'd be hard pressed to really fix those matches. Even if maybe they did get a referee, it doesn't mean you can stop the star players from doing what it is they're going to
Right.
do. But you still have to be vigilant and realize, hey, they've gotten to guys at that level and they'll do it again until somebody can really clamp down on this. And right now, nobody can clamp down on it.
Right. It's pretty incredible. I mean, everybody out there, go read about this. It's like a rabbit hole. Once you start reading, you start Googling a little bit, get your hands on a couple of books. I really just go check out Declan Hill's work.
Well, and the thing is, you don't have to be a soccer fan to understand this. I mean,
No.
I wrote an article about cricket fixing, and I know nothing about cricket, but I understood what was going on behind the scenes, and that's the same thing with soccer. You don't have to be a soccer fan to really realize the organized crime and the gambling and all that element of it. You don't have to care about the game just to realize what's going on within it.
Brian Toohey, thank you so much for coming on. Before we go, how can people find you online?
They can go to my website, which is thefixisin.net. They can find me occasionally at sportsonearth.com, and then my books are available at Amazon and hopefully everywhere good books are sold.
Speaking of sportsonearth.com, where I also happen to write and where this podcast is originating from, do you have anything in the works that you can give us a tease about?
Well, actually, my biggest thing I have, which probably won't be on Sports on Earth, unfortunately, is I worked on a story with Lance Williams, who co-wrote Game of Shadows about Barry Bonds and Balco. And it's a story about a potentially fixed baseball game from 2012, Major League Baseball game.
Wow, 2012. That sounds really juicy.
Yeah, that's where I work. Lance works with a place called Center for Investigative Reporting, and we work together with him. I've been working with him for about 18 months now on this story, and we finally finished it, and hopefully within the next month or two, it'll see the light of day.
We're gonna have to have you back on to talk about that.
Yeah,
You
because
give me you and Lance, give me the heads up when it's gonna run. We'll get you back on.
because it's a crazy story. It's a story that it opens up a lot of questions as to what Major League Baseball can and cannot do, and it's something else.
Fascinating. Looking forward to that. In the meantime, that's all we have for today. For Sports on Earth, I'm Patrick Ruby, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.